Lively here.
Maximo is a sadist and a pervert. In case you haven't heard, one of his kids disappeared. The mother thinks Maximo killed him. Did he and Juju attack Carolyn Ardwin in her driveway?
You always said it, Purcell. If it was Maximo, she wouldn't have a face.
Get out of here, Pookie.
Listen to me. This guy who was following me wears red tennis shoes and fruity shirts and queer bait pants. He ain't out to just cap me. He wants information. You know what that means. Think about what somebody done to Kevin Penny.
I can't help you. Don't come around here anymore. Cleet went up the stoop and opened the screen door.
Don't leave me like this, no,
Pookie said. Cleet shut the door and turned the bolt and clicked off the porch light. He looked through the window. Pookie's arms were thrashing in rage and frustration as though he were caught in a wind tunnel. Cleet couldn't sleep that night. 40 years ago, he had accepted insomnia as a way of life. For a long time, the ghost of a mama-san lived on his fire escape. Sometimes he made a pot of tea for her, then put it in a demitasse and saucer and napkin and tiny spoon on the windowsill, regardless of the terror in his wife's face. One day, the mama-san moved on, and his wife joined a Buddhist cult in Boulder, one in which the members were made to remove their clothes and humiliate themselves, and Cleet was left with a sense of desertion and emptiness no amount of booze or red wings or weed could kill. At 3 a.m, he sat up in the bed and looked at the moon. Homer was asleep on the couch, his cap and ball glove by his feet. He had read Cleet's situation correctly. Carolyn Ardwin was moving in with her mother, but that was a small part of the problem. Cleet and domesticity didn't flush. He had tried it in all its forms. The result was always a disaster. He had even seen a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist had told him to get a vasectomy and never get drunk in Reno or Vegas, where he might accidentally stumble into a marriage chapel. Cleet looked at Homer in the moon glow. His skin was pale and his breath so shallow, his nostrils hardly quivered. Cleet thought of the bodies of the people buried alive by the Viet Cong along the banks of the Perfume River, the dirt clutched in their hands, the waxy look in their faces. The world hasn't treated you right, kid, but I don't know what either one of us can do about it. If there's a way, God help me find it. In any given 24-hour period, we received a steady flow of reports and complaints about house break-ins, car wrecks, noisy house parties, fights outside bars, domestic disputes, a backed-up septic tank, a water heater that wouldn't light, the garbage that wasn't picked up, a sofa dumped in the bayou, a peeping Tom, an alligator in a swimming pool, another alligator taking a barbecued chicken off a grill, possums chewing through someone's wiring, a live skunk that kids had put in the high school principal's car, and sometimes the real deal, a homicide, or a felonious assault, or an armed robbery. The theft of the ice cream truck was a new one. In the late hours, the driver had gassed up in St. Martinville and entered the convenience store for a cup of coffee. When he came back outside, his truck was gone. We added the theft to our list of bizarre occurrences in Acadiana. It was Saturday. The wind was balmy out of the south and smelling of salt and rain, when a man in a Jolly Jack ice cream suit and a white stiff-billed hat stopped the truck by a park in a poor black neighborhood near Bayou Lafourche. Happy tunes jingled from the loudspeakers. The driver stuck his head out the window and waved at the children. There were tiny plastic roses on his coat, like candied flowers on cake icing.
"Hi, kids! Who wants some ice cream?"
"We ain't got no money," the little girl said.
"What if I told you the ice cream is free today?"
the man said. "Then you be lying," a little boy said. The children laughed.
"My name is Smiley," the driver said. "I can make my face look like Wubba."
He made his face go out of shape. They laughed louder this time.
"Do it again, Smiley,"
someone yelled. He hooked his fingers inside his mouth and stretched it until it was almost splitting.
I can speak Spanish. I bet you can't.
If we could speak it, there wouldn't be nobody here who could understand it, the little girl said. So why do we want to speak it?
That's pretty good,
the driver said. He rose from his seat and opened a locker behind him.
Hang on, you guys. Here it comes.
He was wearing gloves. As fast as he could, he trundled out popsicles, fudge bars, cups of marbled ice cream sandwiches, Eskimo pies, and frozen sundaes while more children came running from all over the park. He peeled the paper off the last fudge bar and ate it with them.
How do you like that, kids?
Yeah, they shouted. The little girl stuck her head in the door and looked into the rear of the truck.
What's that sound?
She said.
Which sound? He goes, thump, thump, thump. That's my refrigerator unit. It's broken.
It sounds like you got a gorilla locked in there, the little boy said.
Maybe that's what it is,
the driver said.
No, it ain't,
the girl said.
I got to go, the driver said. Make sure you clean up your trash. Don't be little bugs.
You come here tomorrow, Smiley? She asked.
I got a lot of places to visit. Be good kids.
He raised his hand in farewell.
Hey, everybody, thanks, Smiley,
the little girl said.
Thank you, Smiley,
they yelled. He shifted into gear and drove away, water streaming off his back bumper, the back end swaying and vibrating. He stopped at the end of the street and got into the rear of the truck. He opened a large door that gushed with cold. He looked at something on the floor, his jaw tightening.
I told you to be quiet.
He held onto the door jamb for balance and stomped a mouth-taped figure with his red tennis shoe, then stood on the figure's face for good measure.
You make me very mad. You have been a bad boy. Don't make me come back here again. I do not like bad boys.
On Sunday morning, I got the call. We've got a butte, Pops, Helen said. We haven't been able to get inside the ice cream truck yet, but this looks like one for the books. Chapter 24. At sunrise, a man wearing a Jolly Jack vendor's uniform pulled up to the pumps in the same truck that had been stolen at the same filling station 2 days previous. He turned off the engine and went inside without buying any gas. He used the restroom, bought a bag of ding-dongs, and munched them while he read the newspaper in the convenience store. Then he paid for the newspaper and went outside and did something in the back of the truck. A minute later, the clerk saw him activate the gas pump with what turned out to be a stolen credit card. The clerk had never seen him before and knew nothing of the truck's history. The driver was on the other side of the truck, so the clerk assumed he was gassing up. Someone entered the store and said smoke was rising from the back of the truck. The digital counters were racing on the gas pump. The hose and nozzle had been draped over the driver's window and were sloshing gasoline across the seats and the floor. A flame flickered inside the glass in the rear doors. The driver had disappeared. The explosion seemed to lift the truck off its wheels. Then the fire roared with such intensity that it wilted the roof into carbon paper. One of the customers said he heard the muffled cries of a person inside the flames. It took me only 10 minutes to reach the site. The firemen had finished hosing down the truck, and one of them was prizing open the back doors with a crowbar. Helen was standing by her cruiser, talking into her mic. I waited for her to finish. "What's that smell?" I said.
"I hate to think," she replied. "A car was reported stolen up the road. That's probably how our man made his getaway."
"What's on the surveillance cameras?"
"The top of a head wearing a cap. It looks like he had gloves on."
"What's the clerk say?"
"The guy talked baby talk, like Elmer Fudd, and has lips that were red like licorice. Fudd ate a bag of ding-dongs and read the paper before he set the truck on fire."
"This is the same truck that was stolen from here?"
"You got it."
"How do you figure that one?"
"Our guy's a nutcase," she said.
The fireman was now inside the truck.
He used the head of the crowbar to snap loose the handle on the freeze locker and pulled back the door on its hinges. He jumped down from the bumper, the ends of his mustache bouncing. He coughed wetly in his chest.
"Y'all better take a look."
The man inside the locker was bound hand and foot with ligatures, a strip of heat-baked tape hanging from his mouth. His eyes were wide like those of someone holding his breath underwater. His forehead and bare feet were crusted with black blood, his hair and eyebrows singed, his clothes covered with burn holes. His skin had turned to orange marmalade. I hoped he had died of asphyxiation or a heart attack rather than from the burning gasoline that had curled around the bottom of the freeze locker.
"Recognize him?" Helen said.
"It's Maximo Souza."
"That's him? I remember him being larger."
"He was a small man, inside and out."
"Who's the guy in the Jolly Jack suit?"
"I think the same guy who shot McVane."
"How do you arrive at that?"
"He commits crimes no one would suspect him of. He does it for reasons that make sense to him, but no one else. He builds the gallows and drops the trapdoor before anyone realizes he's not a carpenter."
"Who would want to pop one of Tony Squid's guys?"
"Somebody who wants information about Tony, or somebody who plans on popping Tony."
"Mob guys don't get popped without permission," she said.
"That was in the old days. Whoever did this plans to leave a big footprint." At 7:38 Sunday evening, I got a call from the man himself.
"I'm all broken up. What the fuck is going on over there in Mosquito Town?"
"You said you were not going to call here again, Tony," I said.
"Maximo was like a son to me."
"Yeah, he was a great guy. Maybe he tortured Kevin Penny to death or put a kind-hearted social worker in Lafayette General."
"My people don't do those kinds of things."
"If the price were right, your people would work at Auschwitz."
"Where's your daughter?"
"None of your business."
"I need to talk to her about the script. You're not going to believe who I got to play the role of the Confederate soldier."
When he told me, he was right. I couldn't believe him. The actor was well known and respected. He'd received a Golden Globe Award and other nominations.
"I told him Alethea was doing the script," Tony said. "She's going to love working with him."
I can't tell quite how I feel at this moment.
"What's wrong?"
"Where do you get off using Alethea's name in your business dealings?"
"I'm giving her a break."
"The only break here is going to be in your fat neck," I said.
"Fuck you!"
Maximo went out hard, Tony. Think about the implications. 10 years ago, nobody would have touched one of your guys.
"Put her on the phone."
"Are you listening? My daughter is never going to work with you."
"Yeah, my lawyer already talked with Levon Broussard in the can. He wants Alifair to do the script."
"Levon wants to work with you?"
"Not exactly, but he will. He wants to get even with Nightingale. This is going to be like a telephone pole with spikes in it kicked right up Nightingale's ass."
"I thought you were going to put him in the White House."
"Nightingale is a Benedict Arnold. I kept the unions off his back, introduced him to people with billions of dollars, got him a girlfriend or two. Then one day I'm the stink on shit."
"A heads up, Tony. If a guy who talks like Elmer Fudd and has lips like red licorice shows up at your house, don't invite him in."
"I'm supposed to be afraid of a guy who escaped from a Bugs Bunny cartoon?"
"I think he capped two black guys in Algiers and blew a cop's brains out in the St. Mary Parish. For a while, I thought he might be working for you. Now I think you're a target."
"You know why you're a cop? You're dumb and can't do anything else. For years, Maximo had a thing for little boys. One of his victims caught up with him. Fade to black."
"Sounds more like your epitaph, Tony."
"My dork in your ear, Robichaux,"
he replied and hung up. In the morning, the judge who had remanded Levon Broussard changed his mind and released him on a $200,000 bail. I didn't know what to make of Levon's story about Kevin Penny. Levon had deduced that Kevin Penny had probably raped his wife, but had allowed us to continue our prosecution of an innocent man. Then Levon had gone on his own to Penny's trailer, supposedly to confront him, and had left his fingerprints on the electric drill that had taken Penny's life, supposedly while trying to save him from drowning in his own vomit. But he hadn't called 911. Why hadn't he? He wasn't the kind of man who panicked. His account was a hard sell. Maybe Levon didn't care whether Jimmy was guilty of the actual rape. He blamed Jimmy regardless. As for most of us who seek revenge, his anger and need probably had their origins in the past, and the present situation was a surrogate for an injury that had occurred long ago. Levon's wife had been raped and then abandoned by the system in Wichita, Kansas. I also believed his liberal sentiments and his commitment to civil rights were sorely tested by the fact that the rapists were black. 2 hours after his release from a lockdown unit in Jennings, I found him in his backyard, unshaven, red-eyed, dirty, and still smelling of jail. He was flinging baseballs at a wooden box he had nailed to the side of his carriage house. I had forgotten that he'd played American Legion ball. I'd also forgotten that he'd attended a military academy in Mississippi, if only for 1 year, at the end of which he had been expelled for knocking down an instructor who insulted his family. The ground was littered with baseballs. A cooler with a corked bottle of white wine pushed down in the ice rested on a picnic table. "Pretty good forkball," I said. He looked at me blankly.
"There's a soda in the box, if you want one."
"The prosecutor's office is a bit upset."
"Because they'll have to drop charges against Nightingale."
I didn't answer.
"That's their problem."
He took a wind-up and fired the ball into the center of the wooden box, putting his shoulder and hip into it, whipping his wrist just before releasing his fingers. "You and Jimmy have a lot in common."
"No, we don't."
"You both played ball, and you both went to military school."
"I didn't know that. You know why boys get sent to military school? Their parents don't want them."
"Are you going in on a movie deal with Tony Nemo?"
"If Alifair does the adaptation."
"What you do with Fat Tony is your business, but I don't want you dragging my daughter into it." He tossed a baseball up and down in his hand, then let it fall to the grass.
"Alifair's my friend. You think I'd hurt her?"
"Not intentionally."
"Then give me some credit."
"Nemo is an evil man. Don't darken your life with this guy."
"Nightingale knows how to place his thumb on the pulse of an unhappy electorate. Individuals don't change history. History finds the individual. John Steinbeck said that."
"So let the electorate fall in their own shit."
"I don't doubt Nemo got me sprung. If Alifair will do the first draft, I'm going to make a movie with him. I'll tell you the reason why. My best novel is the least popular of my books. Maybe this is a vanity on my part, but I believe we owe the dead a debt. We have to give them breath and voice, even though their mouths are stopped with dirt. If we don't, they allow us no rest. I think they're out there in the mist. Sometimes I see them."
I felt a wind blow through my chest as though he had pirated my thoughts. "How's your wife doing?" I asked.
"Not good."
"Can I ask you something straight up off the record?"
"Shoot."
"Is it fair to say you're still hanging on to the events in Wichita?"
"Events?"
"The rape of your wife by the two black guys?"
"No, I let go of that a long time ago."
"I don't believe you. People's emotions don't work like that." He slid the wine bottle out of the ice and uncorked it and took a drink from the bottle.
"One of them was knifed to death in the Alabama State Pen. A store owner shot and killed the other one during a robbery. They got what they had coming."
"But they skated in Wichita," I said.
"So that's on the DA's office in Wichita. Fuck them."
"Good attitude. But my experience is that survivors of violent crimes tend to become gun enthusiasts." He winked.
"I throw baseballs."
"Jimmy hits golf balls into the bayou."
"May I visit Alifair at your house?"
"Any time," I replied. I walked back to my pickup. Rowena was sitting in a rocking chair on the gallery.
Mr. Robichaux?
I tried to keep my face pleasant, but I didn't speak. It's my fault, she said.
Pardon? All of it. I got drunk with another man when I should have been home with my husband. I gave you people the wrong information. I caused Levon to go to Kevin Penny's trailer. These things are all my doing.
Forget it, I said. You're a nice lady, Miss Rowena. There was a smile in her eyes. It's strange how much a kind word can do. Cleet Purcell was the most thorough and insightful and successful investigative lawman I ever knew. If he hadn't wiped out his career with hooch and pills and weed and strippers and other women who glowed with neuroses, he could have had a job in the Department of Justice. Instead, he ended up working with the mob in Vegas and Reno. I'll take it a step further. He ended up working for a degenerate killer named Sally Dio, also known as Sally Ducks, who had his boy slam Cleet's hand in a car door. Later, Sally was on his private plane with his boys when the engines failed and the plane crashed into the side of a mountain near Flathead Lake. The coroner had to comb Sally's remains from a tree with a rake. The National Transportation Safety Board said the fuel lines were clogged with sand. For unexplained reasons, Cleet immediately grabbed a flight to Mexico City with only his toothbrush and a shaving kit. Cleet drove his caddy down East Plaquemines Street and Jennings to the sheriff's office. The sky was littered with steel-gray clouds, the air muggy and superheated by the asphalt, the live oaks and palm trees motionless. The building was located in a strange piece of green landscape that had a few small frame houses on it, none of them with fences, like a semi-rural neighborhood from a simpler time. He left his .38 snub and holster in a glove box, put on his pork pie hat, locked his car and went up the walk, touching his face with a folded handkerchief, his collar and his own odor bothering him. The problem did not lie in the weather. Cleet could have overcome his reputation for vigilantism and chaotic behavior, but his brief association with the mob and his accidental shooting of a federal witness followed him wherever he went, in part because he was a better man and a better and more honorable cop than his detractors could ever be. But that was poor consolation. Among those who should have been his colleagues and friends, he was a pariah and a turncoat.
"I'd like to see Detective Picard," he said to the desk sergeant.
"Name?"
"Purcell."
"Oh, yeah," the sergeant said.
"What's that mean?"
"It's been that kind of day."
"How about it, Top? Is she here or not?"
"Down the hall."
"Would you mind telling her I'm here? I don't have an appointment."
"She'd be glad for the company."
He removed his pork pie hat and ran a comb through his hair and put the comb away. He yawned, his eyes empty.
"You got any openings? I'd really dig working in a place like this. It reminds me of Valsal when it was run by the death squads."
"I'll make a note of that," the sergeant said.
Cleet went down the hall and tapped on Sherry Picard's half-open door. She was on the phone but waved him in. She smiled when she hung up.
"How you doing, Mr. Purcell?"
"Cleet."
"How you doing, Mr. Cleet?"
He gave her a look. "I want to run a couple of things by you regarding the Penny homicide."
"I'm all ears."
"Am I about to put my head in a bear trap?" he said.
"I was on the phone with social services."
"About Homer?"
"I think maybe they found a good home for him."
He felt a thorn pierce his heart.
"He's got one now."
"It's only temporary. You have to accept that."
"Right is right, wrong is wrong. I'm not big on rule books."
"How did you make it through the Corps?"
"The crotch was a breeze after New Orleans."
"What did you want to tell me?"
"Remember when we were talking about the latents at the Penny crime scene that weren't in the system? You said it bothered you because a guy like Penny didn't hang out with normal people."
"Right."
"Run everybody who works for Jimmy Nightingale. Also, start looking hard at Spade LaBiche."
"I can't randomly pull in people and fingerprint them, particularly when they're from St. Mary Parish.
There are other ways.
I know your methodology. I want to keep my job. I've got another problem, too.
Like what?
You and Dave Robichaux have a way of getting into it with rich guys. It doesn't do a lot for your credibility.
I'll try to explain that. Most rich people here made their money off somebody else's back.
She looked him up and down, biting the edge of her lip. Unconsciously, he put his thumb in his belt and tightened his shirt. You got anything on Nightingale? She said.
Penny said he made deposits for Nightingale and delivered skanks to Nightingale's house.
Do you believe him?
I don't like Nightingale. I think he's a bum. Not because he's rich. Around here, you screw down and marry up. He doesn't marry up. He just screws everybody. In answer to your question, nothing Penny said was trustworthy. He told me Nightingale's sister came on to him. I have a hard time buying that.
The feds used him for a long time. They must have believed him.
Yeah, they did the same thing with Whitey Bulger. Look, I came here because I thought you could use a friend.
Why do I need a friend? She said.
You work in a shithole.
You're here to tell me I work in a shithole?
It's all relative. Can I sit down? He said.
I have a lot of work to do.
Don't take Homer away.
It's not in my hands. The system is the system.
I say fuck the system, Miss Sherry.
Where has that gotten you, sir?
He felt his eyes go out of focus and wondered if it had to do with the brightness of the sun shining through the window. I'm a PI. When I had a real badge, I never jammed anybody. I didn't do it then. I don't do it now.
Her eyes left his.
They give you a bad time here? He asked.
I get time off from purgatory, she said. Watch your ass, bub.
When he went outside, his caddy was being hauled away by a wrecker. The desk sergeant was watching from the curb.
You were in a no-parking zone.
Allifair was coming out of Victor's cafeteria when she saw Labiche. He was driving a cruiser, looking in the rearview mirror. When he saw her, he swung out of his lane, causing two other drivers to brake. He parked in the shade and got out. He had a gold-tipped cigarette in his mouth. He looked warily up and down the street.
Got a minute?
Not really, she said.
It's important. About our last conversation. Misunderstandings, they've got to be cleared up.
There's nothing to be cleared up, detective.
He turned his face and exhaled the smoke into the wind, then dropped the cigarette onto the sidewalk and stepped on it.
Your father thought I was putting moves on you or something. Roby gets steamed up.
Roby?
Whatever.
He gazed down the street.
It's warming up. I hear this movie deal's coming together.
News to me.
Come on. Levon Broussard is hooking up with Tony Nemo. You're writing a script. It's all around town.
Talk to Levon.
Like I told you before, I know the locale. Or maybe they want to use some real cops.
Could be.
I was an extra in a Miami Vice episode. They didn't do the real story, though. You know the real story about Miami?
No, I don't.
Jimmy Carter let all the boat people in. It took Reagan to stop it.
He squinted across the street at the square and the sun glinting on the tesh. His forehead was shiny, his upper lip beaded. He cleaned the humidity out of his eyes with his fingers.
Don't look right now, but do you see a guy over there?
Which guy?
He's wearing red tennis shoes.
I'm sorry, I don't see anyone like that.
Labiche turned slowly, his arms over his chest. He stared at the square, his lips a tight button.
There are a lot of weirdos around. This guy looked like a perv.
Are you talking about the man who stole the ice cream truck and killed Maximo Sosa? His face blanched.
Yeah. We're getting all points on him.
I don't see anybody in red tennis shoes.
Let's go inside. I'll buy you something cool to drink, or maybe you want something stronger.
There's some people down by the bayou. You don't want to check them out?
He put a fresh cigarette into his mouth and lit it. He shook the front of his shirt with his fingers as though ridding it of the heat rising from the sidewalk.
I got to quit these.
No, there's nothing down by the bayou. About the movie.
Two things, she said. Don't be giving my father nicknames. I'm surprised he hasn't broken your jaw by this time. Second, stay away from me. It's not your fault that you're ignorant and stupid. In fact, you give the lie to the notion of white racial superiority, and for that reason society owes you a debt. But please stop bothering me.
He stepped into the shade. He widened his eyes, his profile as jagged as broken glass, his teeth showing.
Maybe you need a friend down the track. That friend could be me, but I won't be there. Think about that.
You better rephrase your words, trash.
Two people walking by looked over their shoulders.
I might put something in that smart-ass mouth you're not expecting, he said.
What did you say?
He opened the door of his cruiser. Before he shut it, he turned toward her and squeezed his phallus, his lust and iniquity undisguised. That evening she told me what had happened.
Chapter 25. The sunset was like pools of fire inside clouds that were turning into rain. The crowd at the bar and grill up the bayou was a happy one. Before going inside, I stood at the deck railing and gazed at the live oaks on the lawn of the old convent, the people of color who were pole fishing on the bank, the raindrops chaining the bayou's surface. Then I went inside. People who knew me glanced away, either out of embarrassment or in fear. Babette, the young Cajun woman who had told me she'd seen La Biche with Kevin Penny, was working behind the bar. She was serving a high ball to Spade La Biche. In the shadows, at the end of the bar, Cleek Purcell was eating a bowl of etouffee and drinking from a mug of beer caked with ice. He looked straight into my eyes, but didn't stop eating. "Hi, Miss Babette," I said.
"Hello, Mr. Dave," she replied. "You want to order some food, sir? If that's what you're having, I mean."
"Not right now. Just a diet drink. Any kind is fine."
"You're here to talk to me, Rochelle?" La Biche said. "If you are, that's a mistake."
"Why is that?"
"You got a beef, do it by the numbers at the office. That's what offices are for."
I took a glass of iced diet coke and lime slices and cherries from Babette's hand. I had not asked for the lime and the cherries, but she had put them in just the same. I sat down next to Cleet.
"Care to tell me why you're in here?" he said.
"Thought you might be here," I lied. He looked at La Biche but spoke to me.
"You want to eat?"
"Nope."
"You just like slop shoots? Like memories of past Boom Boom?"
I glanced up at the TV screen. "I want to watch the ball game."
"Yeah, who's playing?"
I placed my hand on his shoulder. It felt like concrete. "Think we're too old for this?"
"Old for what?"
"All this crap."
"Don't buy into that. Most people are dead inside at 40. He snapped his fingers. "Look at me."
"I am looking at you."
"You're looking at La Biche. What gives?"
"Nothing," I said.
"Are you trying to have another slip? Because if you are, I'm leaving."
"You worry too much.
Miss Babette, can I have another one of these, please?"
I handed her my empty glass. But I could not say liquor wasn't on my mind. I could not only smell it, I was drawn to it the way a bee is drawn to flowers. The bottles on the back counter rang with light. I could almost taste the foam and brassy bead of the beer splashing from the spigot into a big ice-crusted mug, the whiskey brimming on the edges of a shot glass, the Collins mix and shaved ice and mint leaves and tropical drinks made with vodka and rum and gin. I could not explain the metabolic craving that had brought me nothing but sickness and misery, not to mention a murderous rage that was often the surrogate for the booze I couldn't get enough of. I looked at Labiche's profile and the way he positioned himself at the bar, one foot on the brass rail, shoulders back, half a head taller than those around him. He could see everyone coming in or leaving. He could see down a woman's blouse,
particularly the women behind the bar. He could see a tryst beginning in the parking lot. He could eyeball a parolee who wasn't allowed to keep company with other ex-felons or enter establishments where alcohol was sold. He was Polonius, eavesdropping on the rest of the world. I saw Babette bend over to pick up a napkin from the duckboards. I saw Labiche's eyes follow her breasts down.
"Where are you going?" Cleet said.
"To tell Spade whom he reminds me of."
"Whom?"
I stood behind Labiche but couldn't bring myself to touch him. I remember seeing Babette look at me, her brow furrowed. I remember Labiche turning around as though he heard the bell at a rail crossing.
"Want something?"
he asked. "Repeat what you said to my daughter earlier today."
"I didn't say anything to her. Top of the morning, something like that. You drunk?"
"Think carefully. You asked her if she saw a guy in red tennis shoes. Then you said something else."
"You're a sick man, Robichaud. Everybody knows it except you. In regard to your daughter, I wouldn't wipe my ass with her."
A quietness settled on the bar.
"Did you hear me?"
he said. I nodded. I picked at my nails.
"You just gonna stand there?"
he said. "You're not hard to read, Spade."
"Have a drink. I'll put it on my tab. I'll drive you home. You and your daughter quit your bullshits."
"You didn't make your case on the D'Artes homicide, so you thought you'd go all in."
"I can't take this,"
he said to no one. He slipped a credit card from his wallet and dropped it onto the bar.
"I'm heading out, hun," he said to Babette. "I'll pick you up at closing time."
Babette picked up the card, her face coloring. "Look at me, Spade," I said.
"Geez, what does it take?"
he said, turning toward me. I caught him with my right, putting my shoulder and hip into it, driving my fist straight into his mouth, snapping his face sideways as though he'd been dropped from a hangman's rope. I saw blood fly against the back mirror and heard a stifled cry rise from his throat. I hooked him twice with my left hand and caught him again with my right, knocking his head against the bar as he went down. I should have pulled the plug, but I knew I wasn't going to. The simian that had lived in me since I was a child was back in town. A cloud that was red and black and without shape seemed to explode inside my head and destroy my vision, although I was able to see my deeds from somewhere outside my body. Labiche was on the floor and I was stomping his face, hanging on to the bar for purchase, his blood stippling my loafers. The image reminded me of the blood on the grass where T.J. D'Artes had been beaten to death. A woman was screaming. Someone was on a cell phone. Labiche's eyes were filled with terror. I kicked at his face and lost my balance. I felt the desire to kill him slip away from me, like ash dying on a dead fire. Cleet Purcell came out of nowhere and clinched me from behind and locked his hands on my chest and wrestled me out the door. We were out on the deck, the stars bright, the drawbridge at Burke Street lifting into the air. I pushed him away.
"He played you, big man," Cleet said. "Why'd you let him do it?"
I felt like I was coming off a drunk or getting off a ship without any sea legs. "What happened?"
"Who cares? It's done. Get in the caddy."
"Where are we going?"
"How about another galaxy?" he said.
We walked into the parking lot and got into the car. He started the engine.
"You got it together?"
"Tell me what happened." He exhaled loudly.
"You don't know?"
"He put his hand on me?"
"No, he didn't do anything. You laid him out."
We drove down the street and over the steel grid on the drawbridge. "I didn't kill D'Artes," I said. He looked at me oddly, but I didn't try to explain. At 6 the next morning, I put sardines on the spool table in the backyard for Monticum, then showered and dressed and went to work as though nothing had happened the previous night. No one in the building treated me differently than they would have any other day. Helen seemed preoccupied with the paperwork on her desk. I made some calls to cops I knew in Fort Lauderdale and Miami. I drove to the convenience store and again interviewed the clerk who had sold ding-dongs to the man in red tennis shoes. When I returned, my mailbox was full of messages, and at least half a dozen had been slipped under my door, all from my colleagues. Below is a sampling. Way to go, Robichaux. Rip ass, Big Dave. Fucking A, Streakus. Tell Purcell to finish the job. Next time, cap the cocksucker. Helen tapped on my door. Come in, I said. She sat sideways in a straight-back chair. She was wearing dark blue slacks and a white shirt with a gold badge on the pocket. I felt like I was in a film strip that had just shifted into slow motion. Her face was composed, her eyes neutral. LaBiche isn't pressing charges, she said. I see. You're not surprised, she said. He wants to look stand-up. Why'd you do it? I told her what he had said to Alifair. You should have come to me, she said. I would have done something about it. How bad is LaBiche hurt? It's probably not felony assault. That doesn't mean it's acceptable. She waited for me to say something I didn't. I talked to the barmaid, she said. Babette? She said you backed off. That Purcell didn't need to drag you outside. Could be. Were you drinking? No, ma'am. You think LaBiche set you up? Probably. The prosecutor's office will be looking at you again. You know that, don't you? Here's the rest of it, I said. In front of Victor's, he told Alifair there was a guy wearing red tennis shoes down by the bayou. Alifair said LaBiche seemed spooked, but he didn't want to check the guy out. Like he already knew who the guy was, she said. That was Alifair's opinion. Helen gazed into space. What's your take on all this? LaBiche was probably on a pad for some dealers in Miami. He had ties there to Penny. I talked to a retired detective in Dade County. He said Penny got out of Rayford on appeal after some drugs disappeared from an evidence locker. The detective said LaBiche was a suspect in the disappearance of the drugs. So maybe our man in the red tennis shoes is a hitter from Florida who knows LaBiche. Or LaBiche knows him. But what's the agenda of the guy in the red shoes? She asked. Pookie Domang told Cleet the guy's a cleaner. Pookie the possum? Cleet said he was about to dump in his pants. Can I get a promise from you? She said. What? She squeezed her eyes shut, then opened them again. Forget it. What is it? She stood up to go. Don't get into it with LaBiche again. Got it, Buona? Buona not have time to evolve. Buona clean up brain with vacuum now or get thrown through window. Surprises never end. Just after work on Wednesday afternoon of the following week, Spade LaBiche walked into my backyard while I was washing my boat. Monty Coon was high up in a tree, looking down at us. LaBiche was dressed like a sport in two-tone shoes and a Panama hat and a tropical shirt that hung outside his slacks as though he were trying to transform himself from one identity to another like people do when they can no longer bear their own mistakes in the lives they lead. The swelling had gone out of his face, but the bruises and scrapes were still there. I never thought I could feel sorry for a guy like LaBiche, but I did. There was another element in his face, namely systemic fear, the kind that eats through your stomach and your entrails, or the kind you see in people who know the great shade is waiting for them. Before you tell me to get lost, let me make my case, he said. I squirted the hose on the boat's bow and ran a sponge along its surface. I don't think we have much to talk about. Here's my situation, he continued undaunted. You don't work undercover in Miami without getting dirty. I cross lines. I've been in situations where I had to either let a guy get smoked or get smoked myself. You ever have a gig like that? Close. You let it play out? You let the guy go down? I popped the guys who were going to pop him. I got it, Mr. Moral Superiority. Your meter is running, Spade. I know things,
Nobody else knows. Something is going on that doesn't make sense. I got to have a deal. See, Helen, she listens to you like she's got a thing.
Lose it, I said.
Screw that. I got the key to your head. I got the key to your soul.
Are you crazy? He stepped closer to me, even though the spray from the hose drifted onto his clothes. He must have smeared himself with deodorant rather than taking a shower before coming to the house.
The guy who clipped the St. Mary deputy and cooked the guy in the ice cream truck probably has a list, but the list doesn't make sense. Maybe Tony Squid put out the contracts. I think this is political. That means Jimmy Nightingale.
Who killed Penny?
Was an electric drill? A sadist for hire?
Maximo Souza was a sadist.
I don't know who that is.
The guy in the ice cream truck, I said.
Ask me about Miami. I know all the names. I don't know all the names around here.
I thought you were an expert on New Orleans. His cheek, yellow and blue from my knuckles, quivered like jelly.
This is the deal I need. I keep my badge. Nothing goes in my jacket on this. You help me with Helen. I'll give you some information you can't get from anybody else.
How do you react to perps or corrupt cops who try to bargain? As Alifair once said about her dealings with venal people in the film industry, it's easy. You hang up on them. They can't stand it.
Did you hear me?
LaBiche said. Sorry, I drifted off.
What is it with you? I want to be friends. I didn't file charges.
I think you wanted me to attack you. He adjusted his tie and made a snuffing sound.
Who knows why anybody does anything?
Did you ever destroy evidence or steal it from an evidence locker? I asked.
Where'd you come up with that one? People are getting killed and you're talking about evidence lockers?
Everybody dies, I said. His face drained as though he were aging before my eyes. You all right? I said.
Yeah. Why wouldn't I be all right? Why'd you say that?
No reason, Spade. Have a good one. I turned my back on him and resumed washing the boat. Monty Coon jumped from one tree limb to the next, shaking leaves on my head. When I looked up, LaBiche was gone. Just outside Lafayette, a man someone said looked like an egg with features painted on it, turned off the service road in a Mazda, and parked in front of a rental storage locker. He fitted a key into the lock and pulled up the door, waving to anyone nearby. He removed a cardboard box overflowing with folded clothes that still had price tags and placed the box into the trunk of the car. He did the same with a large and seemingly heavy rifle case. He was almost hairless and wore red tennis shoes that were caked with mud. While he loaded the car, he sucked on a lollipop. A little boy wandered next to him. The man in tennis shoes patted him on the head.
"What's your name, little fella?"
Before the child could answer, his mother jerked him away.
"Why do you do that?"
the man said to her.
"He's not supposed to talk to strangers."
The man took her measure, his face crumpling.
"I don't think I like you."
She hurried to her car with the child, looking nervously over her shoulder. The man drove into a trailer court inside an oak grove on the far side of the service road and ate a sack lunch on a picnic table with people from the trailers. Smoke drifted from barbecue grills into the trees. A ball game was being broadcast from a radio placed on a windowsill. The man in tennis shoes flagged down an ice cream truck and bought popsicles for any kid who wanted one. Then he walked on his hands and did flips across the grass, filling the children with delight. That evening, Juju Ladrine and Pookie Domingue stopped at a fruit and watermelon stand located not far from the drawbridge at Nelson's Canal, a historical site that few cared about and where retreating Confederates tried to stop Nathaniel Banks' invasion into southwestern Louisiana in the spring of 1863. On the far side of the four-lane street were a drawbridge, a church, a pecan orchard, and a pasture with horses in it. The evening star was winking in the west, the light in the trees as bright as a flame, the wind smelling of distant rain. Pookie and Juju ordered big bleeding slices of rattlesnake melon served on paper plates with plastic forks and a roll of paper towels for napkins. They sprinkled their melon with salt and dug in, chewing with their mouths open, enjoying the grandeur of the evening. Opposite the stand was a huge sugarcane field where the cane was hardly more than green tentacles waving in the wind. In the distance, a solitary truck was parked on a dirt road.
There was some kind of battle here, Juju said.
Nothing like the battles at Vicksburg or places like that, Pookie said.
That was in the Civil War?
Yeah, between the North and the South, Pookie said.
Back in the 1960s, over civil rights and shit.
Pookie stared at the side of Juju's face. Juju had been scratching at his scalp and was looking at his nails. Where do you go to school? Pookie asked.
After the fourth grade, I didn't go nowhere.
You could fool me, Pookie said. A black kid was unloading melons and cantaloupes from a flatbed trailer behind their table. Behind the truck on the dirt road, there was a flash of light and a puff of smoke, then a sound like the pop of a wet firecracker. Juju touched his forehead.
What's with this?
What's what? Pookie said.
I got watermelon in my hair.
Pookie looked over his shoulder. The kid was throwing melons around. Hey, kid, ease up on throwing them melons. I wasn't throwing no melons, the kid said. Then why is slop running down your pile? Pookie said to Juju.
Is there somewhere around here we can get laid? Juju said.
And your friend Maximo gets clipped by a guy with a birdcage for a brain and you're talking about coups?
I got the creeps, Juju said.
What you got is a walking nervous breakdown you came out of the womb with.
The wind changed, and Pookie thought he heard another solitary pop. He felt something wet on his face. Juju's head was teetering on his shoulders, then it sank in his plate. Pookie stared across the field at the truck, and at the early cane bending in the wind, and at the amber-tinged twilight glinting on the train tracks, as though he were being drawn against his will into a historical photograph that would have no importance to anyone except him. For a brief moment, he wanted desperately to relive his life and change every thought and deed and event in it, even the ones that were good, in order to alter the sequence of events that had placed him near a site where ragged specters in gray and butternut took their revenge upon the quick. Chapter 26. The sun was low in the west, flooding the crime scene with a red glow when I arrived. Helen arrived minutes later. Someone had pulled a polyethylene tarp over the two bodies that sat slumped at the picnic table. An ambulance, three cruisers, and a fire truck had pulled onto the grass. The crime scene tape was already up. Cars were slowing at the intersection, people gawking from the windows. Spade LaBiche was waiting for us.
Better take a look, he said.
I lifted up a corner of the tarp, high enough to see both victims without exposing their state to people on the other side of the tape. Jesus, Helen said. I lowered the tarp. The entry wounds are in the front.
There's splatter on the flatbed behind them, LaBiche said. One guy said he thought he heard a backfire. A woman says she heard firecrackers.
From where? I said.
Cross the road, he said.
The sugarcane field was empty. The sky lavender and full of birds. The dust devil spun across the rows, wobbling, then broke apart. I walked over to the trailer where a black kid had been stacking or unloading melons. Three melons were cored or broken. There was no bullet hole in the trailer that I could see. Farther down the street were houses and small businesses. I talked with the black kid, who was still shaken by what he had witnessed. One guy was wiping melon out of his hair, then his whole head blowed off. Man, I ain't up for this. Did you see anyone out there in the field? I asked.
No, sir.
Wait. I seen a truck. Did you see the truck go somewhere?
No, sir, I ain't.
You see anything else? Think about it. Maybe a flash behind the truck. You see a man? I can't even remember. That's all right, I said. Let's talk again later. I gave him my card and joined Helen.
Want me to start knocking on doors?
LaBiche said. Yeah, well, we have daylight, Helen said. Good job.
We'll get this guy, he said. Right, Dave?
I didn't answer. He shrugged and walked off. Good job, I said to Helen. Give the devil his due, she said. Remind me to keep my own counsel.
A Jeff Davis Parish Sheriff's cruiser, its flasher rippling, pulled onto the grass and stopped at the tape. Sherry Picard got out, her badge on her belt. Mind if I get in on this?
What's this got to do with Jeff Davis?
Helen said. This is probably connected to the hit on Kevin Penny, she said. Penny is my case.
Help yourself, Helen said.
Who's the Vic? Sherry said.
Vicks, Helen said. Pookie Domingue and Juju Ledrine.
Can I? She said, holding the corner of the tarp. Helen nodded. Sherry pulled up the tarp, her face impassive. She lowered it again and looked over her shoulder at the field. The shots came from out there, she said.
That's the way it looks, I said.
It was probably done with a 50 caliber. I'm thinking an M107 sniper rifle.
Where'd you come up with that?
Helen said. I used one, Sherry said.
Pardon?
Helen said. In Afghanistan.
Let's take a walk, I said to both of them. We crossed the road and walked several hundred yards to a spot where a heavy vehicle had parked and then backed in a semicircle and driven away on its own tire marks. The ground was soft and moist, the impressions sharply stenciled. There were shoe prints by the tire tracks. Helen got on her radio.
We need some tape in the field.
This is my guess, Sherry said.
The shooter set up a bipod on his vehicle and fired through a space in the traffic. That means he's very good. The first shot was high. The second and third were on the mark. The M107 is a semi-auto. Unless he fired from inside the truck, the brass must have hit the ground.
But there was no brass on the ground. If the shooter used a semi-auto outside the truck, he had picked up his spent cartridges, which only cops and professional hitters do.
You got any idea who this guy is? Helen said to Sherry. Somebody who doesn't care if he drills a hole in a house 1 mile away and kills a child in a high chair, Sherry answered.
Our little town was not emotionally equipped to deal with the presence of a contract killer. Oh, yes, we're a libertine and atavistic people with a patina of Christianity, but by and large, our self-indulgence is that of children, and perhaps even an expansion of Christ's recommendation to abide Caesar. Fear spread throughout the town, and Bobby Earle tried to insert himself into the mix, appearing on local television, speculating that Islamic terrorism was at the root of things. But Earle was an amateur, a race-baiter who had faded away with the Klan and the sweaty, redneck demagogues shouting through megaphones on the bed of a cotton wagon. Jimmy Nightingale, however, had found his voice. He, too, appeared on television, usually with police officials or a respected politician at his side. He was avuncular and assuring. He praised law enforcement, the Constitution, our way of life, our people in uniform overseas. As I looked at him on the screen, I believed Jimmy's time had come around. Another figure showed up prominently, as is usual when we lose faith in ourselves and reach out for the worst members of our species. Tony Nemo was back in town in a chauffeured steel-gray limo with charcoaled windows that hid the identities of either celebrities or individuals who would make small-town souls uncomfortable. He reserved the old Evangeline Theater, built on Main Street in 1929, for what he told the Daily Iberian was a screening of his work. The two films were The Attack of the Worm People and Ninja Surf Vixens. After the screening, he threw a grand party in City Park with barbecue and dirty rice and kegs of beer and crawfish boiling in cauldrons filled with artichokes and corn on the cob. The Oaks was